The framers doubted that in a post-George Washington world, the people would ever be well enough informed about who the candidates were.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Education for Sustainable Democracy. My name's Brett Levy, and I'm an associate professor of education at the University at Albany, State University of New York. In this episode, we'll hear from prominent historians and political scientists about why our Constitution does not call for the direct popular election of the president and what the pros and cons of this system are. Every presidential election year, we face our unusual method of electing the president, the Electoral College system, which gives each state the same number of electoral votes as it has members of Congress, 538 total votes distributed across the states. Before you hear from my guests, I'll remind you of some background. The Electoral College system was established in the Constitution in 1787, and it says that each state should appoint electors that then vote for the presidential candidates. But in the early 1800s, states began giving all their electoral votes to the candidate receiving the most votes in their states. James Madison, the Constitution's primary architect, regretted this development, writing in 1823 that the system had been originally designed to have electors chosen from districts within states. However, the winner-take-all system has persisted, and it explains why states that are a sure win for either major candidate, like California or Alabama, get very little attention in the presidential contest, and why competitive states with a lot of electoral votes, like Michigan and Pennsylvania this year, receive tremendous attention. This system also explains how a candidate can get more individual votes, but still lose in the Electoral College, which has happened 5 times in our history. When I talk to historians about the Electoral College, I started by asking why our Constitution's framers thought the president should not be elected by popular vote. Thomas Paterson, a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, had this to say.
They thought if the president was popularly elected in a political system where there was this sense that it was a government of the people, that power would flow to any office that was popularly elected, and particularly an executive office, because it was singular. There was one person there, the closest thing that the American system had to a king.
So Professor Paterson believes that the framers were concerned about the power that a single popularly elected figure might have, and that this individual could undermine the stability of the democratic system that the framers were trying to establish.
That combination of singular authority and then popular selection by popular voting, they felt that could lead to a presidency that could become too powerful, and even the prospect that at some future time that combination could give the United States an Oliver Cromwell, perhaps, who had taken executive power during the interregnum in the English monarchy and had abused it.
When I asked Stanford's Jack Rakove his interpretation, he indicated that the framers' design of the Electoral College was based on their belief that the broader population would not be able to make a well-informed decision about the presidency, given that this was a large country with limited ways to distribute information.
The framers doubted that in a post-George Washington world, the people would ever be well enough informed about who the candidates were, whether the mere dissemination of information would be able to overcome the preferences, or we could say the prejudices, of voters for their, you know, their own representatives or leaders from their own neighborhoods, from their own states.
Then I asked him why the framers didn't just choose to have Congress elect the president, rather than having states select a different group of representatives for the sole purpose of choosing the president.
The problem with congressional election is that if you have a president chosen by Congress, there's a higher likelihood that he'll become the toady, or what was called in the 18th century, the tool of Congress.
So according to Rakove and Paterson, the framers wanted a president who would be accountable and responsive to the whole country, not just the most populous parts, but who would be independent from Congress, able to make decisions that countered theirs. Henry Brady, professor and dean at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy, agrees with these points, adding that the framers thought that a select group of people, rather than the public at large, may be better at identifying the best people to serve in the role of president.
The simple truth is they didn't trust the mass of the public to make such a choice. But the second reason is that they had in their minds the notion that there were great men, and of course
they were thinking of men, not women at that time, and in fact, white men for that matter, that there were great men around, and of course their model was George Washington, and that a group of notables, electors, could get together and identify those people, and in doing so, avoid the mischief of faction.
So these were the framers' rationales. Concern about the power of a popularly elected president, and a belief that a carefully selected group of electors would be better informed about who would make the best president. From the first election, though, states came up with a variety of ways to cast their electoral votes. By 1804, several states began to use the winner-take-all system, with the electors bound to the state's popular vote. And by 1832, just about every other state had followed suit. Keith Whittington, professor of politics at Princeton University, explains why this happened.
That was basically a partisan calculation that parties that thought that they would do well in statewide balloting, that is, they thought they could actually win the majority in a given state, of course wanted all the electors to go with the majority. That means that no state really then has any incentive to water down their own political influence by breaking up their set of electors.
And this is the system we still have today. Many U.S. citizens and political leaders dislike how the Electoral College system has evolved, with every state except Maine and Nebraska giving all their electoral votes to the candidate receiving the most votes in their states. But the only way to get rid of the Electoral College is with a constitutional amendment, which requires the support of two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-fourths of the states. According to Thomas Patterson, there have been hundreds of failed attempts to get rid of the Electoral College, but one gained serious traction in 1969.
The two-thirds majority that's required for a constitutional amendment, they were able to get that majority in the House of Representatives, but not in the Senate.
And even though Patterson doesn't like the Electoral College system, he acknowledges that the direct election of the president would introduce other problems.
What you would have if you went to a population-based system, one person, one vote, direct election of the president, what you would get would be a system that would be very heavily weighted toward attention to the large media markets. I mean, that's where the population is, and that's where you'd find the candidates really placing their emphasis.
Keith Whittington thinks that the Electoral College does have some advantages, noting that a national popular vote could make disputes over ballot counting even more widespread and difficult to resolve than they are under the current system.
If we had a very close election at the national level, in a national popular vote, then there'd be a great incentive to look for extra ballots and to contest the counting of ballots, not just in a single state, but potentially across the nation as a whole. And so you potentially would have a much more widespread fight about ballots and ballot counting in a national system, whereas at least the current system tends to make those kinds of very close elections relatively unlikely to occur at all. And to the extent that they do occur, they focus attention on, say, one state rather than say, let's go look at a few ballots in Florida, and we'll look for a few more ballots in Nevada, and we'll look for a few more ballots in New York, and we'll have to fight all those things all at once in a very short period of time before the presidential inauguration.
All the scholars that I spoke to about the Electoral College acknowledged the huge problems with the system, noting that a few states, representing a relatively small percentage of the population, receive a disproportionate amount of attention from the candidates. Patterson explained it this way.
Because of the Electoral College, the candidates don't even bother with the states that are seen to be safely within the control of one party or the other. Why go to Kansas? It's going to be Republican. Why spend a dime there? Why bother to ever put your foot into the state? And so you get a campaign that becomes focused on 6, 8, 10 states and because they're close. And with the unit rule, if you win, you get it all. That's where the money goes. That's where they go. They distort their policy priorities to appeal to the people in those states. So national policy in many ways gets driven by the 6 or 8 or 10 states that are considered to be toss-up states. And, you step back from that and you ask, is this any way to choose a president of the United States? And my answer is no, not even close.
But despite these problems, it seems like we're stuck with the Electoral College for the foreseeable future. Henry Brady said simply that, as far as he can tell, we don't have the congressional support for a major change.
The Electoral College is just a remnant of something from over 200 years ago at this point, but it's a remnant that's not going to go away simply because it advantages smaller states to such a great degree that they don't want to give it up.
But there are ways to make the Electoral College system more representative of the will of the people. Maine and Nebraska break up their electoral votes in order to more accurately reflect the popular will in their states. And this is closer to what the Constitution's framers intended than the winner-take-all system that exists in most states today. But according to Keith Whittington, it's unlikely that other states will adopt such a system.
I tend to think that the present system is probably about the best that can be hoped for. Increasingly now, there's this calculation that for the state as a whole, that they would have more weight if it was a winner-take-all system, that presidential candidates would pay more attention to the state if there was a bigger prize at the end. And so states are making sort of a self-interested calculation about the political importance of their own state. And that means that no state really then has any incentive to water down their own political influence by breaking up their set of electors.
As Whittington points out, many states, especially swing states, have an interest in keeping the current system in place. But does this mean that change is impossible? Our presidential election system was designed in a very different era, and although it was created in part to provide somewhat proportional representation to the states, the system has evolved to focus candidates' attention on a fairly small number of battleground states, usually fewer than a dozen, leaving most states ignored. Henry Brady and Keith Whittington are skeptical that a constitutional amendment eliminating the Electoral College would ever pass. But there have recently been some creative efforts to change the system. One of these, the National Popular Vote Compact, asks the states to pledge their electoral votes to whichever candidate receives the most votes in the general election. To be effective, states with 270 total electoral votes need to sign on. The effort has gained traction, with over 14 states of all sizes making that commitment. Others continue to advocate for the proportional plan. There are links to articles on these options in the show notes. In the short term, the system seems unlikely to change. But if we really want to make a difference, we can join these efforts or others, knowing that the road to victory may be long, but that the reward could be an executive that is more responsive to the will of the people. This is Education for Sustainable Democracy. I'm Brett Levy. Many thanks to Thomas Patterson, Keith Whittington, Henry Brady, and Jack Rakove. My interviews with them actually took place in the lead up to the 2004 election, 16 years ago. So that explains some of the sound quality issues on the recordings. I'm so glad I was finally able to share some of what I learned from my conversations with them. And I'm very grateful that they spoke to me way back when I was trying to develop a radio show, before there was such a thing as a podcast. If you like this podcast, please give us 5 stars in the ratings section in your app. And if you would tell one friend about the show, I'd really appreciate it. That's the main way to find new listeners and share these ideas more broadly. Thank you for listening.